Hi, my name is Dr. Ruchir Patel. I'm a sleep medicine specialist with formal training in sleep medicine with a background in internal medicine, but also special focus in neuromodulation therapies for sleep apnea, as well as insomnia, but even mental health. Let's talk about sleep.
Let's talk about melatonin. So melatonin is a very common thing that I, as a sleep specialist, get asked about every day in my sleep clinic. But even when I meet people outside and they ask me what I do, they often will ask, hey, what do you think about melatonin? I take, you know, 1 milligram or 5 milligram or 10 milligrams of melatonin. And people just naturally think that melatonin is something that they should be taking. I've met a lot of individuals in my clinic that seem to think that melatonin is actually kind of like a nutrient or a supplement, almost like a multivitamin, that they just take a low dose of melatonin because they feel that it's going to help them sleep better. Now, this is in individuals that actually don't even have a problem sleeping. So my immediate response to them is, why waste money on taking something that you don't really need? Because there is no evidence in our scientific literature showing that taking melatonin on a daily basis is beneficial. There is evidence suggesting that maybe it could be a possibility because there's a multitude of other benefits of melatonin apart from just activating sleep. But officially right now, we don't recommend taking melatonin on a daily basis just for the sake of thinking that if I take more melatonin, that it's just going to help me sleep better than I already do sleep. Now, melatonin is a hormone. It's also called the hormone of darkness. It's a hormone that doesn't start getting released until probably about 6 months of age. So infants, in fact, don't release melatonin. In fact, their brains don't even produce it. And the specific part of the brain that produces melatonin is called the pineal gland. Babies or infants, before they start releasing their own melatonin, typically will get melatonin from their mother if they're breastfeeding, because breast milk actually contains melatonin. And in fact, most bodily secretions actually contain small amounts of melatonin, even your urine and feces, believe it or not. So melatonin is actually secreted in pretty much every secretion in our body. Now, infants, for instance, if they're not getting breast milk, then there is a potential risk that they may not be sleeping as well, right? And that's because they're not getting melatonin from any other source. Formula milk, as far as I'm aware, doesn't contain any melatonin. And there's also a concern in terms of giving, you know, infants melatonin as well. So I would definitely caution parents listening, don't consider that, hey, because my infant isn't getting breast milk, that I should be giving him melatonin. There's concerns over giving, you know, young children melatonin because there's no regulation in terms of the dosing of melatonin, meaning that if the bottle reads 1 milligram melatonin, when it's independently tested in the lab, it may contain 5 milligrams or it may contain 10 milligrams. And over the course of the last couple of years, there's been a higher incidence of young children actually presenting to children's hospitals, ERs, with accidental overdoses, not necessarily, you know, accidental overdose resulting in death, but at least to the point where they're heavily, heavily sedated. So as a parent, and to parents listening, I would definitely not just empirically go buy melatonin over the counter and start giving it to your child. Definitely consult with your pediatrician or even a pediatric sleep specialist because you want to be very cautious. Now, melatonin release is governed by the day and night cycle. And what I mean by that is that our internal clock, which is called the circadian rhythm, it's actually governed by our perception to light, right? So we all see light, and blue light specifically, and in sunlight, right? If you remember from grade school, Roy G. Biv, well, B is for the blue wavelength of light. And that actually is what kind of regulates our internal clock to determine what time the brain wants to go to sleep and what time the brain actually wants to wake up. Well, melatonin is also governed by that same rhythm, the circadian rhythm. Melatonin release typically occurs around 2 hours before our habitual bedtime. So for me, for instance, I naturally get sleepy or tired around 9 to 9:30 p.m. So my intrinsic melatonin release typically starts occurring around 7 p.m. Now, it's a gradual process, right? I don't get drowsy right away because the whole process of melatonin release, it building up in the brain is a very gradual increase over time. And as the melatonin concentration in the brain starts to increase, it then starts activating those regions of the brain in the hypothalamus and other areas that actually release the neurotransmitters that help us to get drowsy and help foster sleep. And at the same time, those neurotransmitters then have a tendency to suppress the other areas of the brain that trigger the release of neurotransmitters that actually wake us up, right? So it's a kind of a gradual transition, so to speak, from wakefulness to sleep. But this is governed at night by melatonin. So that's a big reason why, as sleep specialists, we keep advising individuals to stop exposing themselves to blue light, right? I mean, all of our smart devices, unfortunately, emit blue light. And that blue light, in turn, when our eyes detect it and the retina detects it, it actually basically triggers a reticular activating system, which is a section in the brainstem that also governs activation of sleep or wakefulness, to basically inhibit melatonin release, right? So because it's detecting blue wavelength, even if it's 10 o'clock at night, the brain just detects that blue wavelength light. So it thinks that you're actually being exposed to the sun. So it falsely thinks that it's daytime, right? Even though it's 10 o'clock at night. So that in turn now starts to inhibit melatonin release, or it stops the release of it. And over time, it can actually keep delaying what time melatonin release will naturally occur in your brain. And that in turn over time can actually trigger a sleep disorder called delayed sleep phase disorder. It's a circadian rhythm disorder that we actually see quite a bit in the younger generations. I mean, I'm 45 years of age. I did not have the luxury of having, you know, smartphones or computers and all that growing up as a child. In fact, I didn't have my first computer until I was in the seventh grade, maybe, and that was a luxury. But we, my generation and older generations, we didn't have all these smart devices or smartphones. So we really had minimal exposure to blue wavelength light, except for color TVs. And even then, most often parents were pretty strict, turning the TV off at a certain time. So the presence of this sleep disorder in my generation and older generations definitely overall anecdotally is lower than in younger generations because there's just been so much more exposure to blue wavelength light. So that's why we keep harping on telling individuals that got to cut out screens, you know, your phone, TV, all these LEDs that release so much blue wavelength light. You got to cut them out at least minimally 1 hour, if not 2 hours before bedtime, so that it doesn't push back or delay release of melatonin. But when individuals, you know, don't do this, especially computer programmers, that's a very common population that we'll see this sleep disorder because they're staying up late after school, working on the computer or playing video games or programming, whatever it may be. But that constant blue light exposure from computer screens ends up basically causing the individual over time to become a night owl. And that's this delayed sleep phase disorder. And what I mean by that is that an individual may want to go to bed at 10 o'clock at night and wake up at 5 the next morning to follow kind of a societal normal schedule. But their brain, because of that exposure to blue light in the evenings for such a long period of time, it ends up not releasing melatonin what should be at 8 p.m., right? If the person expects to go to sleep at 10 p.m., but if the melatonin release is delayed to not occur until, say, you know, 11 p.m., I remember melatonin release typically occurs around 2 hours before habitual bedtime. Well, in that person, if their melatonin is not being released till 11 p.m., well, then their habitual bedtime actually turns out to be 1 a.m., right? So if they're going to bed at 10, they're probably going to lay awake for probably close to 2.5 to maybe 3 hours trying to fall asleep. Now, they have to wake up at 5 to go to work, but they didn't fall asleep until 1 o'clock in the morning. So now they slept from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m., so they only got 4 hours of sleep. So better believe that they're going to be exhausted the next day. But when you ask them, hey, when you don't have to go to work or you don't have to wake up early or on the weekends when you can sleep in, what time will you naturally wake up? And 9 times out of 10, they'll say, oh, I'll probably sleep in, you know, 7-8 hours. So I'll probably wake up around, you know, 8-9 o'clock in the morning. So that tells us right away that, boom, this person has got insomnia because of a circadian rhythm issue, meaning that their internal clock is shifted for them to be a night owl. And 9 times out of 10, it's usually the result of excess exposure to blue light in the evenings, but it's not over the course of like a few weeks, right? It's a cumulative effect over several years. Another population we'll see this in is even individuals that have family members, parents that are night owls. Well, then they don't have a tendency to put their children to sleep earlier because they don't think it's necessary because they don't go to sleep early. So by observation, these individuals, these children basically will start developing the same sleep disorder as well. Is there a way for us to be able to correct this issue? Can we change the circadian rhythm in individuals that have this delayed sleep disorder? Yeah, we can actually. And what's one of the ways we do it? We use melatonin. Now we use synthetic melatonin, right, over the counter. So we can use melatonin to actually shift an individual's internal rhythm or circadian rhythm as well. And in this delayed sleep phase disorder, you know, there's a lot of counseling we have to do to get rid of the blue light exposure, but we'll use melatonin at a low dose, typically 1 to 5 milligrams, and we'll have them take it consistently 2 hours before they want to be asleep, right? So if this person's brain is not set for them to go to sleep until 1 o'clock in the morning, but they want to be asleep at 10, then we'll have them start taking melatonin at 8 p.m. Because remember, the whole concept is that melatonin secretion in the brain should naturally occur typically around 2 hours before the habitual bedtime, right? So if this person wants to get to a bedtime of 10 and wants to make that a new habitual bedtime, we want the brain to start detecting the presence of melatonin starting around 8 o'clock, so it can then gradually start activating that sleep process. This is not a very quick process to correct this issue. Then over time, also, you have to gradually advance the bedtime to an earlier time. But that's one of the ways that we'll use melatonin clinically in the sleep clinic, you know, to help a person get better sleep. We don't necessarily, you know, prescribe melatonin, quote unquote, you know, as a sleep aid. I mean, some people will ask, you know, can I try melatonin? And if they're having, you know, some difficulty falling asleep, we can certainly recommend, you know, don't try any more than 10 milligrams of melatonin. But we usually will have them start at 1 milligram. People ask us, is there any specific brand of melatonin that, you know, you would recommend? And truth be told, there really isn't, because there's no regulation in terms of having to do clinical studies on over-the-counter melatonin. So it really is kind of an unregulated, so to speak, supplement. And there's not enough safety data out there for us to be able to tell you, is it 100% safe? There's no large clinical studies that actually have studied the long-term safety and efficacy of melatonin. So as a result of it, we know anecdotally that the most commonly reported side effects for melatonin can include headache, dizziness, nausea, next day morning grogginess. A lot of people will also report just having very vivid dreams and nightmares. But those are the most common side effects that people will report. And that's kind of what we'll report back to patients as well, is that those are the most common side effects that we're aware of. There certainly could be others, but we don't know officially because there's been no large clinical studies that actually have looked at the safety of melatonin. Now, melatonin also can be used to treat another sleep disorder as well. So there's a condition that can occur in individuals with Parkinson's disease where the person loses their ability to paralyze themselves when they dream. Now, when we dream, which is REM sleep, we actually have full skeletal muscle paralysis, which means that we shouldn't be able to vocalize or we shouldn't be able to physically manifest what we're doing in the dream. Individuals with Parkinson's can actually develop this condition up to 30 years before they even develop their first symptom of Parkinson's. Now, one of the ways that we'll treat it early on when we discover that a person is having violent dreams and acting them out, which is a disorder we call REM sleep behavior disorder, RBD for short, one of the ways that we'll treat it early on, if it's not that significant, is we'll actually have the individual take, you know, melatonin at bedtime. Now, I usually will recommend a person take extended release melatonin, so it's a slower release, so that it can actually be more prevalent and present in the brain in the second half of the night, right? Because we usually spend more time dreaming in the second half of the night. So that's commonly the time that individuals that have this sleep disorder will start acting out these dreams. The way melatonin helps is that melatonin's thought to help to induce some of the muscle paralysis in the body during REM sleep that's typically lost. And it actually does work for many individuals. More advanced cases will typically need, you know, a prescription medication on top of the melatonin, but I have many patients where melatonin alone works just fine. Now, melatonin is also being researched very heavily over the last several years, looking at other benefits and other uses for other conditions. So melatonin actually also has anti-inflammatory properties. It has antioxidant properties. It also can help to minimize mitochondrial damage as well, which is something common that we can see even in cancer development. So there's been a lot of use cases and a lot of studies looking at, can melatonin be released? Can melatonin be used, you know, as an adjunct therapy in the treatment of cancers, whether it's solid cancer, solid tumors, especially skin cancer. So melatonin actually is also present in the skin. Most people don't know this. What is melatonin doing in the skin? Now, obviously, it's not to regulate sleep, but melatonin actually helps to prevent UV damage to skin when we're exposed to the sun. So it actually also works in conjunction with vitamin D, because remember, vitamin D is kind of the initial process to start producing the vitamin D. The whole enzymatic reaction actually occurs in the skin once the skin's exposed to UV light. Well, melatonin helps to prevent the damage that UV light could do. So there's a lot of large clinical trials actually looking at, can individuals with skin cancer be treated also with melatonin? Not necessarily melatonin alone, but melatonin plus chemotherapy. And in these studies, it's a very large dose of melatonin that's being used. It's not like 5 or 10 milligrams. I mean, it could be 60 to 100 milligrams of melatonin, which officially we do not recommend anyone take on their own because it's a very high dose of melatonin. But they're using it because of the anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties to see if they can help to reduce the effects of cancer and progression of cancers. And there actually are several studies in the literature that actually show that when supplementing with melatonin, high dose, very high dose melatonin in cancer patients, that they have documented a reduction in tumor growth and tumor spread as well. So that starts to question like, hey, are there other benefits of melatonin? Over the course of the last several years with the COVID-19 pandemic and the COVID-19 virus, we all know now that it has a tendency to trigger a significant inflammatory response. So melatonin also has been looked at and studied within viral infections, bacterial infections. There's even, you know, research looking at can melatonin also be utilized, you know, in the setting of an acute Ebola infection because of, again, the anti-inflammatory properties, the antioxidant properties, but it also has anticoagulant properties as well, meaning that it actually helps to minimize blood clotting, right? So it actually works on the clotting system in the blood as well. So melatonin turns out to actually be a very versatile hormone, not just sleep. I mean, its main function, yes, is the hormone of darkness. It's to help us sleep, right? But it also has these other properties that we didn't realize when melatonin was first discovered in the literature in 1958, or when it was first described in the literature, rather, in 1958, we didn't realize that melatonin had all these other benefits. It's being utilized and studied in a multitude of, you know, various different conditions, and majority of these conditions are conditions or medical conditions that actually trigger large amounts of inflammation. So there's a large study on the use of melatonin as an anti-inflammatory agent. There's also evidence showing that melatonin may even protect the endovascular, which is the inner lining of arteries, right? Which is what can result in, you know, coronary artery disease or even blockages in the carotid arteries, which over time plaque can build up and that could, you know, result in a heart attack or it could result in stroke. Well, melatonin has properties and it's already been shown where it can help to reduce that inflammation in the arteries to minimize plaque buildup, right? Because the whole way plaque builds up in arteries is that when you get an inflammatory response, basically the immune system starts sending all these, you know, little proteins to help fight what they think is, you know, an acute damage. Well, that inflammatory response then ends up causing things to start sticking and it makes the inner walls of the arteries in that specific area very sticky and things start sticking, well, cholesterol in particular. So one questions, you know, there are studies looking at, can melatonin potentially be used in addition to aspirin to help minimize risk of blockages? Of course, I'm not recommending that you take melatonin as a means to prevent yourself from getting a heart attack or stroke, but there's research out there looking at, you know, could melatonin be beneficial as a supplement to other means to reduce your risk of coronary artery disease and stroke as well. Again, nothing out there official as of yet. As I hope you've learned that melatonin has a lot of different uses in terms of how we use it as a, you know, therapeutic tool in sleep medicine, but even within our own bodies, melatonin has multitude of benefits, right? But if I can leave you with one piece of advice is don't try to self-treat. If you've got a sleep disorder, don't just immediately reach for melatonin because it's easily available over the counter. Like I said, there's no regulation in production of melatonin. So as a result of it, you got to be wary in terms of what the bottle reads and what's actually present in that tablet. Because there's been, you know, numerous reports coming out with independent labs testing melatonin, and they're often finding that there's a much higher amount of melatonin in the tablet than what the bottle reads. And too much melatonin, you know, may be detrimental. I mean, there's some research out there suggesting that if you take too much melatonin, that could it, you know, theoretically start to reduce the brain's ability to release its own melatonin. You know, there's nothing conclusive as of yet. So there's a lot of debate in our world, in the sleep medicine world, in terms of what do we advise patients for melatonin. For me, what is my response to patients and other people that ask me about melatonin? And I'll kind of will tell them that, you know, melatonin is natural. Certainly is very prevalent over the counter. You can buy it everywhere, right? So many of the natural sleep aids that have other things like tryptophan and chamomile, it also usually contains a little bit of melatonin. So it's very, very prevalent and it's kind of a buzzword. But I tell people that, you know what, if you want to try something to help yourself fall asleep faster, if you're having a problem falling asleep, which is defined as taking longer than 30 minutes, then sure, try a small amount of melatonin, but don't try anything above 10 milligrams. I've met people that are taking 50 and 60 milligrams of melatonin. We definitely don't recommend that because we don't know the safety. We don't know the safety of what happens when you take that much melatonin. In fact, we don't even know the safety truly, officially, in terms of people that take melatonin at 10 milligrams. So my official recommendation is that certainly try it. It has a side effect of drowsiness. If you're going to take it 2 to 4 hours before you want to be asleep. But if you start getting any side effects or you don't feel that it's helping you, don't continue taking it just to, you know, think that if I take more melatonin, like a multivitamin, that it's just going to help me more, right? There's, again, no research out there supporting it. There's research studies suggesting that maybe, you know, supplementing with melatonin at a low dose may be beneficial. But again, there's nothing official out there. We're not recommending that at this point in time. For parents, be very cautious in giving your children melatonin. As a father of a five-year-old, there were many times when my son, who I was in charge of his sleep, as my wife said, well, you're the sleep doc, so you're going to, you know, you're the one that gets to put him down every night. There were times where I was tempted to give my son melatonin. And I will say, I will admit that I did one time and he threw up all over me. So that was the last time I actually ever gave it to him because he didn't like it. So I think that was a sign from above that, you know, don't give your son melatonin. But be careful because, again, like I said, even the pediatric melatonins out there over the counter, they may read 1 milligram, but they may in fact actually contain more than that. So as a parent, if you feel that your child is having problems sleeping, ask your pediatrician or go see a pediatric sleep specialist for, you know, kind of official recommendations in terms of what to do. A lot of children may even have pediatric sleep apnea that presents with, you know, difficulty sleeping. So don't try to mask it with just giving them something over the counter because you think melatonin is natural and safe. It may not be. So just be cautious. I hope this was helpful. And if you're having problems sleeping, seek help. We're here to help you. Take care.